Courage to Hope with Tony LaGreca is a show supporting the fight for sobriety against substance abuse and changing the stigma that comes along with it. Tony has been helping families, friends, and loved ones discover recovery services as well as coping skills for over 6 years following the death of his own son to opioids. Join Tony and his guests each week as they reveal the courage to hope. Here's your host, Tony LaGreca.
Thank you, Ben. And this is Tony LaGreca, and this is The Courage to Hope. And tonight's guest is Tim. And Tim's got a long story of to get to where he is today, which is in recovery. But he made it, and this is what we want to talk about. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony.
So let's go to your earlier life when you were in school and back in those days. And let's go back in time a little bit. And alcohol was your big issue.
Yes.
And what years did you start drinking?
I started probably at 15, like a lot of
15.
Other teenagers.
So you were like a freshman, a sophomore in high school?
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's okay. When it was started heavy. You know, I think it was dibbing and dabbing. I'm from a big Irish family, and there was a lot of drink around. There was a lot of parties my parents would have. And, you know, typical kids, we'd be, you know, sipping all the drinks afterwards. So that was always there. You know, it was always very curious to the kids, you know, because there was always alcohol present. But I think it started to get to a place where I was getting drunk on a pretty regular basis at about 15, 16 years old. Yeah.
And at the time, did you have a purpose or what?
Preference.
Yeah.
When I was a classy drinker, yeah. It was probably Johnny Walker. I liked scotch a lot, you know.
Wow. High-end drink for a high school kid.
That's what all the people I wanted to emulate at the time, the men that I wanted to emulate, that's what they drank. You know, they either drank bourbon or they drank scotch. And I thought that was a very tough, very cool drink to drink. And then I actually got very used to it in my young 20s and whatnot. I could tell the difference between a good one and a bad one. And, you know, I developed a taste for it, definitely. But that being said, I think from even those days, I wasn't drinking for the taste of alcohol. I was drinking for oblivion. I was drinking to escape. Yeah, even better.
Yeah, so you were telling me that you announced that you were gay. You came out of the closet, as they say, and when you were an 11th grader, junior year in high school.
79.
And tell us what happened when you did that.
Well, it was pretty traumatic. I mean, you know, it wasn't as easy as it is today for certain. And you know, I pretty much lost my group of friends overnight. Wasn't able to attend high school anymore. It became too difficult. And so there was a lot of trauma there. But at the time I was a steam train, you know. I mean, I was partying a lot. I was going out. It was during the dance era, and I was out at clubs pretty much every night, you know. And even at 17, they would let us into a lot of the bars because we would attract more money. The younger guys attract more money, so they did not give us too much trouble getting in to the bars.
Was 18 the drinking age then, or 21?
Yes, 18, right. 18 was the drinking age in New York, where I grew up. I grew up on Long Island.
Oh, yeah. Is it still 18 or is it 21 now?
You know, that's a really good question, Tony. I don't know if they've raised it or not in New York, but that's what it was back then. Yeah. The 11th grade, as I said, I went back and it was really too difficult to continue. So I left, and then I guess in my early 20s, I said it started to, you know, alcohol became a problem early on. I hit my first rehab when I was about 24 years old, and it was a 3-month rehab, And during that time at the rehab, I was able to get a GED. So I did get some form of diploma. I wouldn't know where it is today, but
Yeah, but you
I
did.
did get one. And then after that, I met someone and moved out of the house and was able to, I was really lucky back then. I had some nice people in my life, and the partner at the time actually co-signed a loan for me to go to beauty school, to trade school. And I went to a pretty decent trade school out on the on Suffolk County on Long Island. And it was like a year long of learning how to do hair, and I learned it, and I was really into it, actually. I really was very passionate about doing it, very excited. And as an artist, I was very, it struck all the buttons as an artist, and I thought it was really cool that I could actually create stuff on a 3D palette, So that was a turn on. So I was very excited at 19 to be enrolled in trade school and doing something that I really kind of adored. But the drink never stopped, So school would happen from like 1 to 3 or 4. I mean, 9 to 3 or 4, and then we'd be out at the clubs, all night. And a lot of times we'd be drinking behind the school. It was a party atmosphere back then. And so we a lot drink was always available and always present during those years. So, but it wasn't so much that I couldn't keep it together somewhat at the time, because I think age had a lot to do with it. So I was still a young man. So I just really could keep it up, even though it was pretty heavy. The drinking and the cocaine use and whatever else that went along with those days. So it went along that way, and it went along that way for a long time. I got out of school. I got a job as an apprentice or a junior stylist, and learned my craft pretty well. But I couldn't keep it together, and I would end up back in treatment, and I'd be back in a rehab of some sort. And this was it was becoming a cycle, it was becoming a cycle. And
How much time
and
between
then at
rehab?
age 30, it varied. I mean, back then I could probably keep it together for a year, maybe, but inevitably, once it started, it was getting to the point, and this is where alcoholism kind of showed up, is that it was starting to get it to the point where I could not do without it. And every time I did drink, I was blackout drinker. I was drinking for oblivion. So I could either drink or I could work. I couldn't really do both. So there's a lot of holes in the resume, if you understand what I'm saying. Like I would get these
Oh,
great
yeah.
jobs. I would get these great jobs at these very high-end salons, and I'd be definitely worthy of being there, but then I would drink and I wouldn't be able to, it would blow it up and I wouldn't be able to continue, or I'd get fired, or it just was that circular vicious cycle. But it was interesting, and it went on like that, and it kept showing itself. It's not, it's very ugly when you have a disease that you have no control over, and I didn't know that back then, but I just saw what it was doing to me, and the demoralization, of my life, of how what was happening because of it, and that I couldn't put together, and I took it all very, very personally. Like, well, something was wrong with me. I didn't really know enough about the disease of alcoholism, be able to tell, realize that I was a sick guy, getting better. I wasn't a bad person getting good. I was a sick person getting well, and that took me a long time to put that together. So it went on pretty much chronically relapsing, as I said. And then at 37, it had gotten to such a point, because I know, Tony, that from talking to other addicts and alcoholics, that it is a progressive disease. And mine progressed pretty steadily and pretty low. Not
You,
everybody
did
goes.
you keep the did you keep the same partner all this time, the one that paid for your
No,
schooling?
no, 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 no. After beauty school, I was, as I said, I was pretty wild. I was out and about, and you know, the first one, I was a kid. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And it turned out that it wasn't as, it just didn't work out. And I went from one just into another, just because I needed to take another hostage, as we put it. I needed someone else to babysit me while I drank, you know? So, yeah, so I went, and then after my first relationship, I met another man named Tom, and him and I were just really co-partners in drinking and drugging. Tom was an ex-heroin addict from Amityville, and I never knew he did heroin, but we would go into the city. We still lived on the island, and we would go into Manhattan every weekend, and I would be a blackout drinker. I would lose my way. I would lose him. I remember we'd be watching like guys play basketball down in the village at some of the basketball courts, and I'd have a big jug of wine. We'd be sitting on the benches, because this is what we did, you know, just the whole purpose was to get as screwed up as we could. And inevitably I'd start getting a buzz on, going real good. And I'd drop the bottle, the big Gallo jug of wine would hit the pavement, and it was just a mess, you know. And then I'd lose him, and I wouldn't know how to get back. And, you know, sometimes we were doing like mescaline or something like that. And so some just crazy stuff that happened, you know, trying to get back to Long Island because I had to be at work on Monday morning. Craziness. Okay. But fast forward past those times, you know, then it got really bad, and I ended up being homeless in Manhattan. And this is when it got very down low. I was in a couple of shelter type places. I was actually in a place called the Bowery Mission, which was a very interesting place, because you kind of had to adhere to a very born again, you know, loopy kind of religious way of thinking, and you didn't have a choice. And I was just kind of like, well, I'm getting some meals and I'm out of the rain. So I was really pretty okay with going along with whatever they did. And I'm not saying whatever anybody believes in, but this was just some place that I had to do what I had to do in order to just stay, you know, get some food, you know, because that's where my life was at the time. And so
what year was that?
That must have been early 90s. No, mid to late 90s, probably.
So wasn't HIV a big thing in that time era?
Yeah. And so during that time, let me back up a little bit. After the first rehab, maybe the second one, I ended up going to a halfway house in Manhattan. That's actually how I got into Manhattan to start to live in Manhattan. It was to move into a halfway house that was in the city. And of course, I couldn't keep it together. As I said, you're going to hear a lot of my relapse story. So I'd be in this one. I couldn't even tell you what the name of it was, but I can remember being there. It was in the Lower East Side. And then relapsing, getting kicked out, and getting put into another program or so, because my family was beside themselves. I'm from a very good, nice, good family. I have three beautiful sisters and a brother who is actually a Mormon, lives in Utah, but he's a really good guy. He's got a family of his own and whatnot. We all went different ways, you know, we all kind of got out of the dysfunction in different ways, but it's all good. And they've all chronicled this life of mine, you know, through addiction. And so they were always like kind of finding me and putting me into different programs. And at one point I got into a very good program on the Upper West Side of Manhattan called Smithers. And it was an old mansion. I think it was the old Billy Rose mansion. I guess he was a ball player or something, but it was a phenomenal place. Like, you know, it had a mirror bathroom that they had left. It was just a kind of strange rehab, but it had some of the best counselors, and I mean I still remember it to this day, because I got a lot from it. I learned a lot about my disease at Smithers and what I could absorb at that time. And then from there, they said they thought it might not be a good idea for me to stay in the city, so they the rehab suggested that I go to aftercare in Massachusetts in Boston. So I came to Boston when I was about, I guess it was 24 24, 25, I was in Boston. And again, you know, using the system as I needed it, you know, like, because I couldn't keep it together and I didn't want to. I couldn't understand why at 24 years old, I couldn't drink like a gentleman and hold my liquor up, that I was way too young to be alcoholic and I wasn't going to have it. So I kept trying to find the loophole, as they say, in why I couldn't do it. And that it, you know, I didn't realize how physically, mentally, and spiritually it was. So at that time, so I kept going in and out rehabs, in and out of halfway houses and blah, blah, blah. And then after Boston is when I went back to New York, just got on a train, you know, just like kind of free spirit, just blowing in the wind, just kind of got on a train as this homeless guy and just ended up back in New York. I don't even think I paid for the train ride. I just kind of got on, you know, that was typical. And ended up back in New York. And that's when it got really kind of bad because, you know, I just had no, it just kept getting worse and worse. Like I couldn't keep it together. And I bring it up because there's a lot of times there where the progression got to a point, and other addicts will get this, where I didn't care about anything else but getting the next drink. I didn't care about what it looked like. I didn't care about what my clothes looked like. I didn't care that I wasn't clean. I just needed to get the next drink. And that the incomprehensible, as they say, demoralization of that is really the thing that's just real hard to get over, you know, sometimes, especially after you get sober, you know, you have to look back at some of this. You don't want to stare at it, but man, you got to remember that it happened, you know? And so that went on like that for a long time. I remember being in the city, being homeless in February, being frigid. And you know, you had to stay high if you were homeless in Manhattan, because it's a scary place, you know? I mean, I can remember, we're very smart people, addicts are some of the smartest people, alcoholics and addicts are some of the smartest people I've ever met. And so I was on the streets and I'd figure out things like, in order to be safe, I could climb up on the scaffold. You know, there was a building being redone, like the surface of the building would be being redone. And I figured out I could climb up and sleep behind the plywood up on the top of the landing, you know, on the scaffold.
Oh, yeah.
And no one would be able to see me and I'd be safe and I could sleep, because otherwise it was just too treacherous to be there. But those are the kind of feelings I remember back then. And then
you don't roll over and go off the scaffolding.
There was, you know, if you ever saw like those kind of things, I mean, I'd find a place hopefully that I didn't fall off, but most of them had like plywood set around it so you didn't fall off. So
yeah,
I could kind of, but no one could see me, which was the point.
Where did you get the money to get the drinks from?
Panhandling. You know, I had a cup and I would panhandle. And in fact, there was a time where I got arrested for assault, and I actually did time for this. I did 3 months in Rikers Island for assault. That if you asked me, I can't even remember today what happened, but all I can put together is that I was trying to get some money for a drink. I probably had a cup in front of me or something like that on the street. And someone got too close to me or tried to take my money that was in the cup. And I went ballistic, because that's all I can think that might have happened. But yeah, I ended up, I still this day, I couldn't tell you why. But yeah, so that's why I bring it up, because now things like my freedom's being taken away. Not only am I being demoralized because I'm living on the streets and I can't find a shower, but now I'm being put into the system in having my freedom taken away as well. And this is what perked my tough skull up, is that, wow, this is getting to the point where I don't have any say in it anymore. I'm going to be put away in one way, shape, or form from my actions, because you're responsible for your actions, whether you're screwed up or not. So
right now you're in Rikers. What did you do for alcohol? Or did you go into?
I didn't.
Detox.
I detoxed it in jail. Yeah, you don't You don't get alcohol in jail. No,
I know, mean, but I mean, did they? There, but... Did they? Was anybody? You know, you could die from being detoxed. You know, especially if you're drinking hard liquor. You know, so.
Yeah, no, that could have definitely happened. It probably, you know, I probably did convulse once or twice, and maybe more. I don't know. I mean, there's times where my family will tell you that, you know, I'd wake up in an emergency room, and I'd be like, well, what the hell happened, and where's my jacket? Because if I had a bottle, it would be in my jacket. So I'd be looking for my jacket, and it was just, again, so demoralizing, because they would cut the only clothes that I had off. So I'd wake up and I'd be have my jeans all cut up because they were trying to intubate me or put the charcoal down my whatever. They always cut my clothes off. I used to get so pissed. But that would happen too. So it was this kind of like constantly being in this dire straits of all of it. And at the same time, having a disease that had matured to a place where as soon as I got out, I still made the decision to get my next drink because I had really kind of given up at that point to a greater degree. I just really, I didn't think I was going to live through it. So I figured might as well just keep going on this way. But then it got, and I always hated it. You know, I would piss myself on the streets and then I wouldn't be able to get another pair of pants. I remember going to a little thrift store down on Bleecker Street, you know, and it was a thrift store that this lady was always there, and she'd see me and she'd be like, I'd knock on the door again and she'd be like, ah, you again. But she always did give me a pair of pants. You know, this is the God thing. Cause even when I was using, I had someone that was watching over me because when I needed a drink, I got one. When I needed a pair of gloves, I got one. When I needed a pair of pants, I got one. You know, even though all I thought about was getting to the next drink. So that's the way that went. And that got as probably as close to me wanting to off myself or wanting to be dead, just not having the courage to do it, as I got. And
what about food? Were you eating food?
Soup kitchens. I knew where all the soup kitchens were, and I would people would give me food a lot, on the streets. You know, they'd say, oh, you know, I don't have any money, but here's my dinner. And, I remember stuff like that, but again, Tony, that wasn't the thing that mattered. So I would go days without eating because it was more important to buy booze than it was to buy anything to eat. I wasn't thinking that way. The only thing that dominated me was finding the next drink. So that went on like that until I was about 36 years old, almost 37, and I stepped in front of a sports car on the West Side Highway. I was running across the street in a blackout. I don't remember it happened. I just remember the police report, but I got hit by a sports car and it hit me just below the knee, and it going about 50 miles an hour and shattered both my legs. I was thrown about 50 feet from the car on the West Side Highway, if anybody's familiar with that.
You're saying West Side Highway. You're talking about the Hudson River Drive, right?
Yes, right. Hudson River Drive, yeah. West Side Highway.
What were you even doing? You have no idea why you were even down there because you're not supposed to be on that.
That's where I felt, you know, down off Christopher Street and stuff. That's where most of the gay people were. And I was usually down there most of the time. That's where I stayed. I didn't go up to sometimes I'd be in the East Village because I'd wander over that way. But a lot of it happened on the West Side, the lower West Side of Manhattan. So, so I was kind of running across the street and I got hit by this car and I don't remember any of it really. The cop said that I was thrown about 50 feet from the car. I woke up in the emergency room, or woke up in the recovery room, I guess. I thought I was just in the emergency room for drinking again, because I get these good Samaritans, you know, these like religious people, a lot of them, but very good people. And they would just be like, what's this kid doing here? You know, and then they would like either take me to a hospital, and some of them tried to take me back to their houses. Sometimes I end up in like a basement in Queens. And you know, some, you know, religious woman was gonna like fix me or something. So at this point I thought I was just in the hospital again for drinking. So I'm like, well, where's my clothes? I need to get out of here. And the nurse said, no, you're not here for drinking this time. You just got out of 7 hours of surgery. An orthopedist just put your legs together, back together. And I said, did they know if I'm going to walk again? And she said, no, they don't know that yet. Very snide, because people that don't understand addiction, they can be very nasty to the people that they have to deal with sometimes. But she was very snide. And she's like, nah, they don't know that yet. So I kind of, at that point, I had said, if I had any kind of spiritual kind of wake up call, that was it. Because I couldn't imagine that I might not walk again. And that's really what they were telling me. And so I went through however long in the hospital, and then they transferred me to a nursing home in Brownsville, Brooklyn, which isn't a really nice area, or wasn't back then anyway. And so this is kind of a very kind of low-end nursing home. And I had to spend a year learning to walk again. And that's what I did. I spent the time learning to walk again, and kind of had a lot of time to think, a lot of time to kind of evaluate. And it kind of saved me. So in a lot of ways, you see how this spiritual thing, even though a lot of this stuff sounds so devastating, it did get me to places where I could have a clear moment and make a decision whether I wanted to continue to do this, or maybe find ways to live my life without it, and what I would need to do that. So I ended up staying clean and sober through that. I got back on my feet, and I moved to a place in the lower end of Manhattan for people that had HIV. Because I was back in Boston, just before I left Boston, I was diagnosed with HIV when I was 27 years old. So, and back then it was still a death sentence, you know, you just didn't know. So that kind of fueled everything as well. But it unveiled me to put into a residence that was for HIV people. So I ended up moving to a place called Bailey House on the bottom of Christopher Street. So I went from living in a nursing home while my legs healed for a year to what used to be a hotel. Bailey House used to be a big kind of hotel. And it was right on the corner of Christopher Street. So it looked at the Hudson River. And it had a roof deck on like the 30th floor, I forget, but it was a pretty tall building. And it had this incredible roof deck that you could see the whole thing. I mean, you felt like you were freaking, you know, it felt like you were Donald Trump standing on this rooftop. And
like a high-end hotel.
It was at one time. And then they turned it into this, you know, this nonprofit took it over and turned it into Bailey House. And it was really a very, very well-known and very, very well-respected place during the AIDS crisis, which I lived through, you know, and a lot of my friends or people I knew were all passing. I can remember how dark those days were, because I was sober now, and I could see with clear eyes what was happening around me, and it was not. It was devastating, to say the least. So, and having it yourself, you didn't know what was going to happen from 1 month to the next, what was coming up as far as medications, how we were going to get our hands on the medications. And people were pretty much up in arms of what was happening and why we weren't able to get what we needed back then. So it was pretty heated at a lot of different times during those times. And I had said to myself, you know, I have it, but I'm not going to take the drugs of the time. I made a conscious decision that I wasn't going to take the AZT or the Crixivan or the some of the other drugs that were very toxic. And I could see in my friends how toxic they were. They would get what they called Crix stomachs and Crick necks, where they would get like humps on the back of their necks from the medication. And, you know, it was just, and it was toxic to themselves. The AGT was a very toxic drug. And a lot, I think it added to a lot of people passing. You know, I think it did more harm in a lot of ways than it did good, but we didn't have any alternatives at the time. So I said, I'm going to wait, and I'm not going to do anything, any drug at all, until my T cells get to a point where I absolutely unequivocally have to, or I'll die. And so that's what I decided to do. And it just by, you know, divine intervention, I was able to live long enough for the protease inhibitors to come around. And I didn't get the Kaposi's sarcoma or the other illnesses and that were associated with HIV. So those times were dark. And but I had gotten to the Bailey House, and I was like, "Wow, I'm not on the street. I'm not homeless. I got food to eat. I got shelter. I started going to meetings on a regular basis, and life started to get better. You know, I was cleaned up, and you know, I had if there was kind of a pink cloud of anything, that's kind of when it happened. It was about this time, because I had realized what had happened to me. You know, it went from Rikers, and then shortly after that to the accident. And I was like, and here I was able to walk again and pretty cleaned up and living in a place that was affordable and that I could stay, whatever. So went on like that. And I guess at 37, I met another person, and then met another guy, and at a campgrounds, actually. And we fell hard. And I would run the other way, you know, because I didn't want to put myself in any other harm's way. I don't know. I was too frightened to get involved with anybody at that point. But he was very persistent. He was 22 years my senior, and I loved him. Oh, he was just a great man, and he said, "Well, let's just have a date. We'll have one date. I'll come into the city." I said, "You live 2 hours from here, and it's never going to work. And I don't want to even try, because I don't want to see what my, you know, I don't want to get into this kind of long distance thing." And so he persisted, and he was like, "Well, let's just have a date and see what happens." So we had a date. And shortly after that, it just was inescapable. At that point, things got real good. He had a place in New Hope, Pennsylvania. He had gone to Rutgers and was working for the power company in New Jersey. He was just a very established guy and really good guy. He had been married to a woman and had two daughters that were my age. And it kind of happened just really, it just didn't, none of that mattered that he was old, that much older. I mean, it's just really it was a love story. And I just, I had never felt that with anybody, you know? So I still say today he was the love of my life. And that went on for about 7 years, and life got so, so good. I mean, it was trips to Mexico and Paris. I saw Paris and I saw Italy. I mean, here's this person that lived on the streets like 3 years before, and now I'm on the Eiffel Tower, you know? And it was just, it was a dream, you know? And I was going to meetings on a pretty regular basis, but the relationship and the back and forth and things that I wanted, because now I was okay. Now I had everything back and I was okay. So I didn't need what was being offered to me as far as the solution to my alcoholism. by going to meetings and working a 12-step program. I didn't need you. I had gotten the information from these people, and I was gonna go and do it on my own. So I stopped going to meetings after about 5 years of this relationship. And lo and behold, 2 years after that, I ended up having a cocktail in Mexico. And there was everything for them to just get me on the plane and get me back to the States. So, and then shortly after that, the relationship broke up because no one can deal with active addiction of any kind. I mean, it gets to a point where even the most wonderful people are going to not be able to put up with it. And I had a hard time dealing with that, you know, because I didn't, this is what why I bring up all this life history, is because I never wanted to take the responsibility for anything. It was always everybody else's fault. And if I wanted to continue to drink, which is what my mind wanted to do all the time, I had to get angry enough at someone, or I had to get to the point where, see what you made me do? It was all your fault. And see, those are the manipulations that have to be alive for me to keep drinking. And make no mistake, my head can still go down to a place where I'll start saying, is this all there is? Hey, you know, that you have been really bad to me, and now I have a reason to use or to drink, you know? And it took me a long time to realize that there is never going to be a reason to do it, and that I have to do certain things if I want to keep it. It doesn't just happen even today, and it doesn't sustain itself on its own. I can get just as bat crazy. I was there. I can get just as crazy today if I'm not careful as it was after the 5 years. See, because I had gotten everything back and I didn't need anything else from you guys. I didn't want to admit that I was, like, you know, this homeless, hopeless alcoholic, you know, and I didn't believe that that would ever happen again. And so I did it. And after, I made the decision to have the one drink. And it took me years to realize that that first drink was the one that did it. Okay. Because by the time I took the second drink, and I didn't believe this for years, I couldn't put this together. I don't know why, but it was the second drink that got me drunk. Because, I mean, it was the first drink that got me drunk, because the second drink was taken by a completely different person. Once I ingested the first one, there was a different person up here. I had set up the mental, physical compulsion that I had no control over. As the disease of alcoholism, that's the whole thing in a nutshell. And it took me many years to realize that that's what happened. And that, so my job is, I have to avoid the first drink, because after that, I don't have a choice. And for years, I thought I would. I thought, oh, I'll just have one little one and I'll be able to do this, just like, you know, regular guys that don't have alcoholism. And I could never understand why I couldn't. So it took me years to realize that. That it was the first drink that got me drunk. And so in order for me to stay away from the first drink today, I have to take care of it. I still go to about 3 or 4 meetings a week. I just moved from Florida, where I lived for about 18 years. And I had a good group down there. I went to both NA and AA down there, but I had a sponsor and I had a good group. And since I'm up here, I just joined another good group in Lynn, Massachusetts. Very, very old time AA, which I love. It's like, it's a basement, and it's like all these. It's no nonsense. You get in there.
Why did you move up here?
It was. I got into an affordable housing, so I was able to qualify for that. So, yeah. So that's why I made the move, because it was very hard for me to live at this point in Florida. I couldn't afford to live in Florida anymore. So I was looking for other ways that I might be able to keep a roof over my head and whatnot. So it came to a point where this came available, and I qualified for it. Yeah.
How long have you lived in Massachusetts?
Oh, I'm only here since I just made the WU in January.
Oh,
I'm
okay. So
I've known newbie. The reason why we know each other, Tony, is because you know one of my dear friends that I knew back in Boston when I was 24. And we've stayed in touch since then. And that's how this came about. And you getting to know that I was alcoholic and wanted to speak to me. But yeah, so that's how that happened. And my friend was very instrumental in helping me get onto lists and do what we had to do to eventually find a place for me to stay. But this is real nice. And again, the longer you stay clean and sober, the higher the perch is that you can fall from and make, you know, I don't make any delusions. And that's why I'm in the best place in my life, because at 62 years old, I really want to be able to convey a life that I had that wasn't what we call a one chip wonder. I didn't go to my first AA meeting at 19 and say, oh, this is Nirvana. Of course, I'm going to do everything you say and I'm going to really love it. You're right. Because I can see that, that was not me. And I needed it. I needed it from day one. I was a fall down drunk by the time I was 19, but I couldn't get that through my head. And I didn't know that there was a program that I would have to kind of pay attention to if I wanted to keep it. And so I just didn't think that I was too young to be there, whatever it is. I just couldn't do it. And I bring that up now because now I'm 62 years old. I've lived my whole adult life has been spent in the circular motion of going through treatment, going back out, getting life into an incomprehensible demoralization state, and then living through it enough to come back above water, get a little bit more clean time, put my life together, appear like a normal, respected human being in society, and then blow it up again. And I did that over and over again because I couldn't put together that I had to do certain things if I wanted to keep my sobriety. And those things are, I have to go to meetings, I have to work a 12-step program, I have to have a sponsor, and I have to have a home group. And I have to be active in that home group. So these are the things that I have to put in place if I want my life to live anything near normal, you know? And I'd say that's it can always be refunded. I wake up every day and there's, in our literature, it says, I get this one day as a reprieve. And that reprieve from my disease is based on my spiritual condition. So my spiritual condition, I can get up I believe in a higher power. I know some other people use the higher power at the group as the higher power. Anything that's larger than me is the higher power. And I understand people that don't believe in a God having that. But it's been my experience that I do have a higher power that I call God. And if I get up in the morning and I put my feet on the ground and I say, thy will not mine be done. I'm as selfish as they come. And you ask any alcoholic, we come first. And where's the next one? And where's more, more, more? I want more. And don't you know what I did? And it's about me and I need more. If I waking up and saying, God, what do you want me to do for you? That's different. That's big that I can make a change like that. And I don't always, I'm aware of it, but if I get up and don't kind of consciously make an effort to change the channel from my self-centered brain and say, okay, well, what can I do to be of service to another alcoholic or another suffering person? Where can I put myself today to do something as simple as go make a pot of coffee at a meeting or show up and just be there so that someone walking in the door has someone else to greet them? I might be the only one that's there when someone walks in, and that might be their saving grace. So what, and you never know, like how you're helping people, you just don't know, but showing up has to happen for that to happen. So I put my feet on the side of the bed and I say, do with me what you will today. You know, what's your will for me today? You know, I pray for that. Please keep me sober. And what is your will for me today? You know, and when at night, because I know what it feels like to not have a bed. So at night,
take your time.
At night, I know how important that bed is and how grateful I am for that. They say, you know, and my sponsor always tells me, you know, and other people, a grateful heart's never going to use, you know, if you're aware of where you've come from and where you are now, and that it can happen again if you don't do certain things, that you tend to think harder about it and you tend to do what people say. And what I was told to say was to stay grateful and see what you can do for the next man that suffers, you know? So that's what I do today. And it dominates my life, and it has to. It has to be the most important thing in my life, or else I'll end up repeating it, you see? So, and I did that, but yeah. That's kind of where that's at. Yeah.
So when you get up in the morning, you go out for walks, or
yeah, I go for walks. I go to a meeting at 11:30 three times a week up here that I found, and I'm still starting to get acquainted with the area. So I try to keep myself active and moving around, and I have a lot of hospital stuff happening now, because I just found out recently that there's some prostate cancer going on, which I hear that if you live long enough as a guy, that it kind of it'll affect you in one way, shape, or form. So recently a lot of the time has been being spent getting appointments set up for radiation and stuff like that, which kind of scares me. But you know, it's like, again, it's all it is a one day at a time, if you can ever get that concept. You know, it really is. No one knows what's going to happen the next one. I just have to go through the motions and do what I'm told, you know, make the appointments, do what the doctor says, or if I have to go through, make a decision to go through this therapy or that therapy, and then follow through. And so it's just very grown up stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of alcoholics don't like to think about, you know, but yeah, it's big boy pants stuff, you know, but anyway, I'm getting through it, you know?
Yeah. Let's go back a little bit in time here for a minute.
Yeah.
So you've been sober 7 years.
Nah, so yeah. Well, in October, if I get to October, I'll have, 7 years.
7 years. Okay. So and 6 years and 4 months.
Yeah. It'll be the second time that I have 7 years. But the thing that's different this time is that I don't take any of it for granted, and I understand now that me getting away from a program with other people that have the disease that I have, then me by myself is still in a really bad neighborhood. This can turn into a really bad neighborhood really quickly, you know? So I'm very, not cautious. It's not like I live like on eggshells. I just know at this, I finally got the memo that if I don't treat my alcoholism, that it can and most likely will return. And so that's what I'd like to maybe get across in our conversation today, is that there's got to be someone maybe listening that's 22, 23, suffering with some kind of addiction. I know there's a lot of meth use and a lot of other drugs. And, you know, I was addicted to crack for a little while back when, and I mean, the drugs of that day, but man, there's some real lethal stuff out there with the fentanyl and the meth. And the only reason I never did meth is because no one ever put it under my nose before I got clean. You know what I mean?
It was kind of a California thing, Western United States. And
I'm just saying that I'm not coming from a place of like, oh, you know, that's like bad. No, because that is the only reason I never did it, was because someone didn't come and put it under my nose and make the decision, because it's always going to be my decision of snorting it or shooting it or whatever was available, and making that decision, you know. But if I can keep myself in a place where I'm talking about what happens all the time, and I'm seeing what happens when you go to meetings, you know, I might have something to offer because I've been doing it for a little while or whatever, but there might be someone coming in right there that's not, that was where I was, where they didn't want to be ready. They were all of a sudden they found themselves in a church basement. Like, what the hell am I doing here? I'm 20 years old. Well, if you're sitting in a church basement, the likelihood that you belong is probably really great, you know, because I wish that I could have walked into the first meeting that I went to at 19 and gotten it then. You know, my life would probably have looked very, very different, because if you don't, and you do have the disease of alcoholism, you know, because life, normal drinkers, you know, even kind of heavy drinkers or whatever, don't really end up in church basements because their life is unmanageable. That's really what it comes down to. Life becomes so unmanageable, and I can't keep any of it together. So that's part of the first step. You know, my life, I was powerless over alcohol, and my life became unmanageable. That's the second part of the first step. You know, and that's what catapults us a lot of times, because it's so embarrassing and so demoralizing. We're like, holy shit, I can't believe I did that last night. And the pain of that, the wrenching pain of what we go through because of our drinking, and because we don't have any control over it once it's in there. That's painful. It's really, it's a very painful place. But there is hope and there is recovery. And so if someone sees where I'm at and says, see, you know, and I talk like that, I talk like this at meetings too. I'm like, yeah, you know, I got this winter coat, and I know what it's like to be freezing. But now I have a winter coat. Look at this, you know, you know, and that's real nice to have. Just got to remember where it all stems from, because if I don't do certain things, then it all disappears. It all disappears, you know, once I pick up. And my family, as much as they love me, I have a great family. I really, they love me. They, if I called and I was drunk, they just hung up the phone.
Yeah.
they have just seen my shenanigans and my life for so many years that if I was to call, I wouldn't even have to say anything. All I could say is like, hello, how you doing? And they'd know exactly, they'd know right away that I was drunk, and they would just hang up the phone. In other words, my family does not enable me at all. And that's a really good thing, because then I have to scramble again, and maybe I'll scramble back into a meeting before I kill myself, you know, and that's the hope. But I don't want that to ever happen again, but that's their look on it. And they're very proud of me. And you, if you talk to any of them, if you talk to my sister, Kathy, she will say right to my face, I'm the strongest person she's ever known because of what I've gone through, you know, and me just being on your show, Tony, if whatever I've said tonight is anything, it's hope for someone else that might be really struggling and suffering right now. And it's a phone call away, you know, literally you can pick up that phone. I know it's not the easiest thing to get into your first meeting, but we all had to do that once. And once we were there, you met with hugs and understanding, because most of us, all of us know what it's like to walk into that first space, not know what's happening, but be freaked out and panicked because the life is unmanageable and I just don't know what to do. Well, they made it that far, and that's really the first step, is to put it down, you know, get it out of your system enough so you can have a clear thought, and then get to meetings where people can teach you how to work a program where you could keep it, where it could be kept. It can be a great life, you know. I mean, I saw younger people while I was in Florida. One in particular comes to mind, but he got away from the methamphetamine. He had a head on his shoulders, and I think he just celebrated 6 years, but he went back to school during it. And I mean, life gets big, and the bigger life gets, the more I need to tether myself to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I can't trust it that it's going to be, I can't just say, okay, I've got this and thanks for the gumball and I will be on my way now. It's just never going to work that, not for me. It's not going to ever work. And I haven't ever seen it really work that way for other people. Other people that do get away from the meetings, or do get away from helping others in one way or another with their addiction, it kind of like, there's such a thing as white knuckling it, you know? And none of us are perfect, you know? It's like, there's, I don't want it to come off like I'm doing everything that I need to do and whatever. I have days where I'm still just as crazy as a loon. And the only thing I can muster is to get to a meeting and have someone else tell me how crazy I am that day, you know? But it's still, I didn't drink. You know, as long as I don't drink, there's hope.
I was thinking about you being homeless in Manhattan in February. And that was before global warming. It's a little warmer now, but back in the day, I remember February in New York was always like the 20s. And for those who have never walked the cities of Manhattan, when you go around the corner and you're in the middle of a tunnel of buildings, It's 20 miles an hour, maybe outside, but it's 30 or 40 miles an hour wind blowing down that tunnel, you know. So
it's brutal.
It's very raw, very cold. It doesn't matter which way the wind blows, it's blowing off of either the Hudson River or the Long Island Sound or something, you know, and it's cold. It's the oceans right there, you know. So,
and I went during those times, Tony, I had angels. I mean, I remember I had a friend of mine. I met her at a meeting. I can't remember. She had saw me and she was trying to help me out or whatever. And I wasn't keeping it together. But then she saw me again on the street. She was in a restaurant and she was looking out. And she said to her friend, she goes, "That's the guy. That's the guy I saw." And she came out of the restaurant to say hello. And I said, "Maria," I said, I don't need another drink right now. I said, "What I need is gloves. I'm frozen, you know?" And she got me a pair of gloves, you know? And that's what I mean. Like, that's how God happened when I was out using. But my decisions can make me dead, you know? Like, I flatlined a few times during those years. And then of course the horrific accident, but I mean, that's, you're just so at mercy of that, you know, for happening. But at the same time, you know, I don't know. I like to think that there's a reason why I'm still here, because I can't come up with a good one sometimes, you know, when you play the videotape, like, I think it's a lot of it's just like dumb. I don't want to say that. I mean, it's not really dumb luck, but what I'm trying to say is that I could have been gone a long time ago, you know? And I know that hits a nerve because of your experience, Tony. And sometimes you feel, I've gone through the feeling of feeling guilty. Like, how come I'm still here? You know? And I don't know the answer to that, but I know that I could have, you know, expired as well during those times. And I think I wanted to, I just didn't have the guts to do it. There was times the pain was so great that I did want it to expire. And watching that pain in myself and others where I've seen it, and it's just, there's no hope. And that's where the program comes in. Once you can get into a place where you can remove the substance and have a clear thought, then all of a sudden, you know, a little light comes through the window and you have a little bit of hope. The door opens a little bit, and then you can learn from other people that have walked this way how to continue to do it and how to stay humble and grateful enough that you don't try to do it yourself and put yourself back into a hopeless situation. So
what you're saying, Tim, because we're just about out of time, is that when you feel hopeless and you feel like you want to expire, put your hand out and ask for help.
Ask for help. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the moral of this long story.
You know, and Alcoholics Anonymous is all over the world. You know, I could hang up here. When I got to Lynn, it took me 2 days in Lynn to find a meeting and another kind face that had the same disease as I had. And now I had to do the work. I had to get in my car, find that meeting, get to it, get to Malden or wherever it was. And that was up to me, because that's my response. I'm responsible for my recovery today. So it was for me to get there. That was important. But once I got there, if I was having a bad day, I needed to cry, or I needed to tell someone something so warped that I couldn't really tell someone else, or something that's going on that seems seemingly trivial, but not to us because it could make us use, I can find someone there to talk about it, and they know what I'm talking about. I tell my, you know, I've said in meetings before, I never feel more comfortable. Even when I was drinking, I would go into meetings and I'd still be drunk, because the only requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous is the desire to stop drinking. You can go to your first meeting being drunk, okay? As long as you don't disturb the meeting, which I was known to do after I was drunk, so they kicked me out a few times. But as long as I don't disturb that meeting, I can sit and maybe stay and get some warmth or get some love or get some a cookie and a cup of coffee or whatever. But at least I, you know, there's hope there. And you have people that are trying to hold on one day at a time, just like you, you know. And then you have other people that have lived and worked a 12-step program, and they can teach you how to work a 12-step program if you have the willingness and you're open enough to have that happen. And the key word there is willingness. If I'm not willing to do it, then it's not going to happen. You know what I mean? It's got to become from you. You're the one that has to admit the first step and make that first step. But after that, the hoop you have to jump through is not as tight as you might think, because there's people around that are going to help you and be there. It really is. It's an amazing God-given program in my mind that has saved my life. And I don't take it for granted, not one bit today. And yeah. I hope I never do in the future, you know.
Well, I feel pretty strong. You're gonna stay sober, because there's a lot of people around you now that care, but you, as you say, and the name of our show is The Courage to Hope, and you've had the courage, and now you've given other people hope. And that's where we're at today. And Tim, I want to thank you for sharing this hour with us and letting it all out. And so you can keep going. And this is Tony LaGreca, and this is The Courage to Hope. And we'll see you again next time. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Tony.